From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made just a couple of weeks ago when most schools said goodbye to their students for the school year. Summer is a little different this time around. It's a chance to rest, to decompress, but also to evaluate what has been working or not working in the classroom. And for a growing number of teachers, it's a time to think about quitting. A new survey from the RAND Corporation shows that 1 in 4 teachers is now considering leaving the profession after this most recent school year. That's up from an average of 1 in 6 before the pandemic. According to a co-author of the report, quote, teachers were almost twice as likely to report that they were experiencing frequent job-related stress as the general employed adult population. And about 3 times as many teachers said they were experiencing symptoms of depression as the general adult population, end quote. Our hope this summer is to have a series of conversations with educators about what they've learned during this pandemic and what needs to change. This is not just a moment where we look around and say, there are vaccines, and now we can just go back to where we were. This is a moment to ask ourselves in just about every facet of life, what should change permanently? Let's talk to our guest this hour. John Baines is a teacher at Our Lady of Mercy. You might know him as a Monroe County legislator in the 18th District, but he's also been a teacher in the public schools for almost 40 years.
39, yeah.
39 years in Fairport. 2 at Aquinas as well?
Yeah.
Total. So you're entering year 46. 46? You've done 46 years of teaching.
I'll start my 46th year in teaching in September, God willing.
And still going strong.
Love it.
Still happy to do it. Okay. John Lewis, you were one of John Baines' students?
I was.
Is that correct?
When I saw him
walk in.
We didn't even know it. I saw him walk in. I thought he was after my homework from 20 years ago.
John is a UPK preschool teacher in the Rochester City School District. It's great to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. And so, again, listeners, it's just one of what we hope will be a number of conversations about these subjects. But we're going to start in very general fashion here. John Lewis, you've been teaching for how many years?
I've been teaching for three.
Three.
So it's got, you know, I haven't quite been alive for as long as John's been teaching, but...
that hurts.
I'm sorry. That sounded like a burn.
It was supposed to be
like, no, that's reverence.
To be a compliment.
That's reverence.
Exactly. He definitely was a teacher that I look back on. And actually, we were just talking about it. I actually don't even think I ever had him, but his presence in the school was certainly very influential.
Well, John Baines, if you say you love it just as much as you ever have... What do you make of the numbers that a much higher number of teachers are saying, you know what, maybe this is not right for me. I got to quit.
I would never judge anyone for feeling that way. I have a lot of kind of earned but also accumulated privilege. I don't have children at home. Our children are grown. Mm-hmm. So you have to look, when you look at the American worker and the American professional and you look at the stressors, it's a profound experience when you feel like you're struggling with your family. And as I once shared with some primary teachers, and several of them burst into tears, I was so worried about them. They were so stressed because teaching 6-year-olds and 5-year-olds is 50 times harder than what I do. I teach 12th graders. They drive cars, okay? I can't do damage that is lasting by having a bad lesson. I'm not going to turn them off to reading or speaking. Maybe a little bit, but when you teach 6-year-olds, that is so formative. So I said to this group one day, I get the feeling like you guys drive home feeling like failures, and then you leave your children and drive to work feeling like failures as parents. It seems like that's underneath a lot of the stress, and that I was feeling like waves of stress in this particular school, Dudley School. Fantastic school. It's a K-2. And about 5 women burst into tears and said no one ever acknowledges that. So I'm very lucky in that I have a vast repertoire of 45 years of work. I am teaching part-time. I am doing it by choice. I'm not doing it because I necessarily need the income. So I would never judge those teachers. In fact, what I want to do is listen to them. Why are you feeling that way? How can we help you? How can we game up with your colleagues and other supports? Because we need you. We cannot afford to lose teachers because there are not a lot of people waiting to do it, Evan.
Yeah, that is such a good point. In fact, we just already heard from a listener named Joel who just sent a note saying, not good statistics considering a growing shortage of people who want to enter the field.
Right on.
Yeah. And so do you feel like this is a moment to not just catch our breaths, but to say, we don't have to go back exactly how we did it before?
Oh, I absolutely feel that way. And in fact, during the pandemic, I was disappointed that we weren't more flexible in thinking about how to make it a teachable moment for the profession, the systems, et cetera, how to think about redeploying resources and doing things differently. And right now, there is such a colossal sigh of relief. Hopefully, the variant won't knock us off the beam for that. Mm-hmm. And there is, and the premise of your show, I totally agree with, which is, right now, I think people are just so anxious to get back to normal. Number one, normal wasn't as good as it needed to be before. And now we've gone through this experience and we've found out what's happened to vulnerable populations, which we'll talk about in the show, and how vulnerable populations were underserved. There's also, I just want to say this, though, I think there's a lot of good news. Despite some of the people who kind of lost their minds during this process, I think most people realize how interdependent we are. Families depend on schools. Schools depend on families. Some of that was really stressful. But for the most part, I feel like our community responded well with some stressors. But now is the time to listen to the people who had a negative experience and learn from that. And I'm talking too much. My former student over here needs to talk.
Oh, no, that's all right. You're very kind. Well, John Lewis has been working a little bit fewer years so far, and maybe it's 46 years in your future.
That's
goodness,
right.
Maybe 50. Do you still like the work three entering your fourth year? Do you like the work?
Well, yes. And from my perspective, having only done it for 3 years and this past year being my third year, I was sort of, especially hearing those statistics, I try to look, you know, in my mind's eye at my day-to-day and see if I saw any of that. And I saw a lot of the people who had been used to teaching or had done it for more years than me sort of completely blindsided by the idea of applying completely different techniques to how they do it. And and aside from having their own struggles at home, I think that took away something about how they felt if they were doing anything correctly. There was a sort of a feeling that because everything was new, that you weren't sure if you were even getting through to kids and if you were benefiting them the way that you really had hoped you would be. But being a little younger, I was also really energized by the idea of applying more virtual content, more ways of doing teaching online. Despite my concerns about that, I actually was really excited because I feel education has been not accepting technology in its day-to-day life like it really should, and now we had to adapt it. So let's figure out what about that application is going to be, like you said, beneficial in the future, not to be dropped.
Before, John Lewis, before we blow up the phones with people saying, interpreting your remarks as saying, endorsing almost total Zoom lessons, et cetera.
Sure, right.
That's not what I'm hearing from you.
Right, and I'm with five-year-olds, too. So to say that I want a five-year-old to sit on a Zoom call is certainly not it. But there are ways to supplement things that you're doing in person with also virtual teaching. And in the terms of communication to parents, this year I talked to all of the families of my students far more than I ever have before.
That's interesting you say that. That is exactly what a teacher named Alicia Simba, she's an elementary teacher in Oakland, California. She wrote a piece for Education Week about what teachers have learned. And I'll quote from that now. She writes, "Teaching through this crisis pushed me to closely communicate and collaborate with parents more than I might otherwise have done in a normal first year." She was a first year teacher. She says, "Like many other teachers across grade levels, I was prepared for the traditional and often harmful expectation that parents leave their kids at school and hear minimal updates beyond parent-teacher conferences and misconduct. For years, many families have felt shut out of their children's education, blocked by mistrust, bureaucracy, and language barriers. This year, however, schools were forced to bring families into the classroom in what one of my classroom parents described as a co-teacher dynamic. I relied on the adults at home to facilitate and often directly support instruction. I found that working together with parents created a mutual respect and a greater appreciation of the hard work of teaching and parenting," end quote. You agree with her?
Absolutely. And that, I think, is echoed all throughout many teachers that I work with. And when you look at the students that truly did have that ability to focus and be there. It was their working with their families that allowed them to do that. Their parents or their parental figures were right there, and we could talk to them, you know, day to day and get updates as to how they were doing. Even before Zoom was applied, because there was a time when it was literally like we didn't even know how we were going to teach, we would be able to use online platforms to send pictures back and forth with projects and things that we could do completely online, and that was really cool.
But the obvious, I think, concern is that that creates a very uneven field for 5-year-olds for you, 17-year-olds for you, everything in between, of families, how engaged they are. And that's not sort of to malign families. Some don't have the time. Some single-parent households. Some parents are working 3 jobs. I mean, there is child homelessness at high levels in RCSD especially, but everywhere. So it's an uneven opportunity given that. And that would be my concern, I guess, John Lewis, is that, you know, I don't know what I can expect from
absolutely.
That.
And what we got to realize at our school was if there was, you know, one, even just one student that was not able to get on those Zoom calls, that was our reason to get kids back in. Even if it was just a small amount of kids that were able to come in, some kids were doing better with Zoom. Some families were able to do that.
Sure.
And then others, we had to figure out a way to get them back in the classroom. And deeply, I feel that that's the best, obviously, environment for any child of that age is to be able to be in person.
Okay, so just to put a fine point on this, I'm going to ask both of you to elaborate on a little bit of what John Lewis just said. I'm not here to sort of malign teachers who did not feel comfortable coming back. RCSD in particular and the RTA were very concerned, and I understand. There were a lot of concerns about ventilation system, about getting back before widespread vaccination, about older aging staff and more vulnerable staff members. All of that, I think, is reasonable. And that's probably its own conversation still, because we're still looking at the fall asking what we should be doing. And that's its own conversation. This is really about teaching techniques and learning what works. So acknowledging that the concerns were realistic or fair, you're making a point that just because everyone could do this, if there was one kid in a class or five, if you didn't find a way to get them back in the classroom and you couldn't even see if they were online with you in lessons or even there, what was your concern if you kept doing it this way for weeks and months or even longer?
It was definitely that at that age level, especially it's interaction and behavioral development that we're working with. So are they going to be able to do crisis management? Are they learning how to work with others? Are emotionally, are they being supported? You know, are they getting that sort of everyday support and development that we would normally be giving them in the classroom just by letting them play with each other? And our concern was how to safely open a classroom environment where they could experience it that in at least some small degree as regulations were sort of being lifted.
John Baines, what was the, if we don't get some of the students who are most vulnerable back in person and we're not reaching them in virtual lessons, what happens?
That was the tragedy of this year.
Yeah.
The disengagement of students. And one of the things that we learned, and by the way, let's just preface this with the caveat that never extrapolate from your own experience in this game. So as you just pointed out, because I teach young women who drive cars, that's not, they're self-regulating, and that's not the same something that would apply to other circumstances for.
But you've been in public schools but here's the for point. 40 years. You've got colleagues everywhere. I know you're plugged in.
I'm talking today, not from my point of view. This is my point. I warn people, never look at your own point of view. I'm talking from representing for 30 years, 600 teachers at a time.
Yeah.
I probably represented 2,000 teachers approximately or close to that during that 30-year period. So when I talk about these issues, I actually am talking about it from being in primary classrooms and being in other classrooms all those years.
Yeah.
So I do, I think that the problem, the whole pandemic was driven. If people didn't understand the superintendents are trying to shuffle this thing off to Dr. Mendoza or shuffle it off. But the superintendents operate in one premise. I know them well, and I know the way they think. They didn't want to lose one child. When you're a superintendent of schools, you're fear. You're up nights worrying. Am I going to lose a child? And they didn't want to do so. They were unbelievably cautious, and they should have been. And I would never attack them for that. And so let's flip that to the teacher. The teacher's the same. You can't, you know, it's like that one child. If you lose one child, it's the most devastating and heartbreaking thing that can happen to you as a teacher. So in my case, I was essentially had to go offline. I mean, you can't shame people. Shaming, by the way, if shaming were a great motivational device for teaching, I would have been valedictorian of my Catholic school. You know,
shaming really doesn't work anywhere.
It doesn't work.
And yet all of our modern media tools encourage shaming.
It's insane. So, you know, how do we lift up students who are disengaged or struggling? Well, we have to meet with them one-on-one. We have to sometimes build a team. So, you know, I would find valued and trusted adults in that student's life, try to become one. And usually you don't have a lot of time. It's not September. During September it might be hard, but as the year goes on, what's going on? How can I help? And that's essentially how I can appeal to a student of that age. It's not necessarily as easy when you're working with a six-year-old who can't self-regulate and can't articulate the reasons why she or he is struggling. So, you know, it's that's the game. I mean, we don't in this business, we're not measured by John Lewis. I'm not measured by Phil Hoffman. He was a student of mine. I'm not measured by V.J. Iyer or Andy Martino, who just wrote a book. I'm measured by my most vulnerable student. And, you know, that's, to me, that's my number one priority, just like those superintendents. So we have to do everything we can to reconnect and reestablish relationships with them.
That is such an interesting way of thinking about it, and it should be obvious. But what John Baines is talking about, think about the way we rate school districts. The districts that get the highest ratings are almost always in the wealthiest communities. Mm-hmm. They send students to the best schools, to the best, you know, the highest rated colleges. Mm-hmm. They have students who are very highly ranked academically and go on to sort of big jobs. And so when you have a V.J. Iyer or a Philip Seymour Hoffman or any of these, any number of people who've come through local districts, the district understandably perhaps wants to say, hey, that's one of ours. We're very proud. But what have you done? How many students who come in literally dealing with poverty or homelessness or other challenges exit your system in a much better position in life?
The biggest growth...
That's a great way to measure it.
The biggest growth factor in public education has been the explosion of special ed and the explosion of social work, mental health professionals. The problem is time. We're only with the children half the year. And so the children are in attendance in a secondary environment for maybe 170 days of 365 days in a year. And it's an extremely expensive model. We have to transport the child to the school. Busing drives everything in the big schools in terms of the schedule and the sports schedule. And these are comprehensive schools, as they should be. They're trying to provide physical education, which was devastated by the pandemic. They're trying to provide music education. John's a product of one of the best music programs in the state, the Fairport Music Department. And so they're doing so many different things, and all of those puzzle pieces have to fit together. And the problem I think that we have is that we're out of session so much. So, and we're having it, you know, now.
More school?
I don't know that we should come out of the pandemic without thinking differently about how to deliver it. It doesn't mean that John would have to work 250 days a year. But I do think, you know, one of the greatest educators I've ever met, I'm very, very chauvinistic and prejudiced about it, is my wife. And she runs a community library. So they were traumatized by the pandemic like everybody. Mm-hmm. And then they had a meeting and said, we just got to do everything differently. So they started creating art kits for kids to pick up because they knew kids were at home. So they would create all these, and then they would drive by. They were realizing we're going to do book clubs online. They had their best book club they've ever had. They did knitting online. You have to go to the people. This is why I'm so proud of John for working at Baden Street and you know, community-based solutions. Right now, how do we get everybody vaccinated? Well, we got everybody who showed up. Now we got to go find them, right?
Yeah. So you got to go to the people.
We got to go to the people, right? So if we're talking about our most vulnerable students, I do think we need to think differently. People talk about summer drop-off educational drop off. Like, it's the old cliche, you lose your skills, right? Like between second and third grade.
Yep.
And we get, well, what about all the other drop off? You know, the other drop off, which is really more profound.
But
which
what's
is,
the solution that you see? If this is a change that's got to come out of this pandemic, what's the solution look like?
Well, I think we need to look at public education, private education, not-for-profits, and think about how we can keep young people at their most vulnerable phases in their development connected to professional adults.
Does that mean more time in school classrooms?
Not necessarily.
Okay. Then what's an example?
We can think differently about a lot of things. But, you know, the saddest day of the year is the last day of school. Fortunately, my students have such great families that I'm not as worried about them.
Yeah, no, I got
but,
you.
But there. I worry about them.
You worry about all students, I'm sure.
I just worry about them.
Absolutely. And does that mean more summer programming? Who pays for that?
I think the society, I mean, we're paying for everything right now. It seems like investing in children is always a great investment, and we can figure out ways to do it. We have some great recreation programs. I live in the town of Parenton, phenomenal recreation programs. Henrietta has great, the city has great recreation programs. But I think we fall short in the interface and the coordination and the collaboration between systems. And, you know, we know who vulnerable children are, and we need to use a team approach when we identify a vulnerable child, the ones we're really worried about, okay? I mean, let's be honest. We can tell children who are most at risk to drop out. We can tell children who are most at risk to do crime and to, you know, struggle. So how can we think differently about that? Because the heartbreak of the pandemic were the students who were failed, you know, and I know families. I've talked to families. I've had calls. I've had tears from families who said, my child suffered. And it just breaks my heart.
Oh, I mean, I think some of what we're seeing this summer with growing violence and sort of lashing out is a product of so much of the last year and a half. John, can you take me through what kind of average day was like for you in dealing with, in the heart of this pandemic, when almost everything was online, and you're trying to make sure, do I know where these kids are? Are they at least there? Are they healthy? Are they safe? What were you doing?
That was an interesting time. And I think what we ended up doing is, because we would have these regulated Zoom days when it was all digital, and the kids would have basically morning and afternoon split up lessons. And if we could see certain kids weren't signing on consistently, or their environment was changing, that their parents were having a hard time or their guardians were having a difficult time getting them on, and we were able to sort of say, okay, what if we reach out to this family and come up with a different time? So it would be outside of even regular school hours sometimes, where, okay, that child could sign on at 5 o'clock tonight. Do you want to be on as a teacher and run through class then with them? And on to supplement with that, we could also have supplies delivered right to their house. So many times over the pandemic, when things were all virtual, and even when it was half and half, we would get these supply bags together and actually go to the houses and drop them off.
Did you go yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it would be the one time in the last 4 or 5 months where we would be able to actually see somebody. It would be from the street corner, and we would set the stuff on the door. And then that child we would all have already known is having trouble getting on at a certain time. So now they have the supplies and a different time that we've come up with to work with them. And that's how we sort of were able to feel better about being able to work with families more. You know, it was more coming up with ideas, you know, and doing anything that we could flexibility-wise.
Yeah, I think we could really just even work a plan for vulnerable children with their.
You mean going forward, pandemic, no pandemic.
Yeah,
no,
right.
Like, obviously, we want to build in for 8-year-olds. We want to make sure that the plan is to have fun and to be active and kick a ball or whatever that is, right? But also, how can we say to mom and dad or grandma, grandpa, or guardian, these are some exciting things happening this summer that will bridge to the fall semester? These are exciting things happening in our library system and our recreational program. And one of the things that is insane in this country, there are 3 million teachers and they're all dragging their own sleds. I mean, there are materials available online. There are materials. If I think we could do a much better job of sharing resources with families, not just community resources that can come to them or they can go to, but that they can access through the expertise of other people online.
Yeah, I think, you know, thinking about John Lewis driving materials to families and maybe even just waving from the street.
Absolutely, yeah.
To stay in touch or to at least say to yourself as a teacher, okay, here's this six-year-old, at least they're okay. I can see them.
Exactly.
That keeps some thread of connection. That doesn't have to change. And I'm sure somebody's going to call me and say, we've been doing that anyway. But it seems like there can be more connection. So that maybe what's something else that stands out to you, John, that might change permanently or may alter the way you think about how you reach kids?
Well, I think that is what I would hope would be what we could focus on, is not dropping these sort of things. And if organizations have done things like this, but if we could connect us to the school program and have that connection and that communication with families still going there, you know, online, you could be posting. I was making lots of online content for my kids because it was like a specialty that I had done before. So I was coming up with these videos that were going along with lessons. I was writing
music,
songs
there you go.
that were about different emotions. And instead of doing it just for my own side project, it began to become part of the supplemental educational material. And I think that kids, regardless of whether they were coming into school, were benefiting from being able to touch base virtually that way. And then coupled with the supplies, I was actually blown away by the amount of supplies the district kept giving. Boxes on boxes of glue and paper. and I think a lot of teachers were, their eyes were open at that point too. Like, hey, if we can get these resources all the time for each individual kid, what's stopping us from continuing to do that later on so that kids can take home these materials and they don't just have to have them in school?
I got to say, Evan, I'm really proud of you, John. I'm so proud of you, and you're such an inspiration to me.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, you're the OG inspiration.
Well, I don't know about that. But, you know, one of my theories about kids and all children is that their greatest fear is abandonment. And the trauma of being abandoned. And you can be abandoned with two parents in the house, and you can never feel abandoned with one. It's a sensation that haven't been a priority, if you will. So this is why, for instance, school attendance by professionals is so important. I didn't miss a day of school this year simply because I'm terrified that my students will think that I don't care. You know, and that's way too much pressure to put on yourself. That's why teachers want to leave the profession. I mean, it's incredibly high pressure. The more you care, the more you hurt, the more difficult it is.
Yeah.
And those teachers who are leaving, they're not quitters, okay? They're maxed out, and they're hurting. So, I think we got to get back to that. So when we talk about abandonment, I mean, that's that sense that people don't care. And when you are at a certain age in your development, so one of the reasons that students struggle is transitioning. And we put kids through so many transitions. And sometimes in Fairport, I was worried because we had to go from second grade to in one school to third grade in another, et cetera. So, again, I think we can do a better job of focusing on meeting students' needs and collaborating as an adult community in helping children make transitions.
Well, I'm going to get to some phone calls and feedback in just a second here. And so, listeners, I see the phone ringing. If you want to call the program as we talk about what worked for kids during the pandemic, what was different in classrooms, what needs to change going forward? 844-295-TALK is the way to reach us. 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. Or you can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. After we take our only break of the hour, I'll get some of your feedback. We're going to talk about the value of art, and John Lewis will probably appreciate that.
Sounds good.
Joy in the classroom. You know, fun came up. That was one of the words John Baines used. Education Week had a whole section on how hard the last 15 months have been and the value of still finding joy. And we'll talk a little bit about that. And we'll also talk a little bit more about how we make districts, you know, focus to make sure that their metrics for themselves isn't just how many of our students are nationally known successes. It's how many of the students who came in really vulnerable exit the experience here in a really safe, healthy position. And that's different. John Baines is a teacher at Our Lady of Mercy, 39 years in Fairport, 2 at Aquinas, entering 46th year of teaching. He's also in the Monroe County Legislature. John Lewis is a UPK preschool teacher in the Rochester City School District. And we're glad they're both here, and we'll get some of your feedback next. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about a four-day work week. Have you tried it? If you work for a company or a small business, have you ever taken a shot at just 4 days instead of five? A permanent three-day weekend? What would that do for productivity? What would it do for you? Good idea or just a fantasy? A four-day work week next hour.
This is Veronica Volk from WXXI News, and we've got a new weekly podcast for you. It's called Earshot, and it's got all the most important, best told, sometimes off the beaten path news stories from your favorite WXXI and city reporters. Earshot comes out every Friday. Don't miss it. Subscribe wherever you find your podcasts.
This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's get some feedback. Scott and Palmyra first on the phones. Go ahead, Scott.
Hi, thanks for taking the call,
sure.
Evan. And John, I wanted to compliment you on bringing up the idea of doing schools a little bit differently and looking maybe at the calendar a little bit differently and bridging that gap between the end of school and the beginning of the fall semester. That was something that I was talking to my wife about just last week, about ways that we could do that and incorporate the different programs so that kids don't lose connection. So I thought that was it's fantastic that people are already thinking about this.
What do you think that looks like in practice, though, from, say, June to September, Scott?
You know, you're getting into the idea of thinking only in June through September. I actually think that we need to rethink about our entire calendar differently. You know, I would actually like to see an extended school year that was, you know, didn't have the 2.5 months off of school in summer, but maybe had a couple weeks off and extended vacations into other seasons as well, so the students are more consistently in school or have programs, and not necessarily always class time programs. You know, if we looked at it differently and thought about more active programs in the summer versus less versus more academic programs in the summer, you know, the things that get the kids up and active and having fun, but more regulated through a school. You know, it's just an idea that is just starting to form in our heads now. And a couple of reasons also, I mean, that also can help parents, working parents especially, who are looking for childcare during the summer. You know, that 2.5 months for us is really difficult,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. John Baines, how seriously might districts take this?
Well, you know, they do it. My main point of reference is Fairport. I'm so proud of Fairport Schools and how well they do. And they have a program for a middle school. It's very joy-focused, and it's not available to everyone. It's available to students they're concerned about. It's been very successful for many years.
What's it look like? Is the calendar different?
Yeah, it's the regular school calendar, but in the summer, teachers come in and work with the population of students who's been identified as eligible and whose families choose to access it. We also have reading programs for students who are struggling with reading at our primary level in Fairport that are incredibly important intervention programs. So there is an appetite for as Scott says, for families. And I think that it's not actually well known that these programs exist, but expanding successful models like the ones at Fairport would be a great way to start.
How open, though, are districts going to be to that? Because, you know, there's a lot of inertia with the calendar. We still vote on Tuesdays, okay?
Yeah.
It's really hard to change how we do things.
I'm not talking necessarily about the hard calendar for buses rolling.
Gotcha.
Okay. I'm saying that you can have a hard calendar for buses rolling, and then you can have a rich array of choices to support families that are not necessarily the traditional school day. One of the problems I think we have about schools is what I call the covenant of the past, if you will, or the covenant of the status quo. Schools are places where parents went, and they often expect, and I understand a replication of their experience. But everything has changed with families, and not everything with children. The fundamentals are the same. But I do think that, again, reimagining schooling in America is not a radical enterprise. We actually have a lot of successful programs that could be replicated by other districts and other communities.
Mm-hmm. Well, John Lewis, when you think about your 5-6-year-olds over these summer months, how many are you concerned about sort of losing touch and kind of stalling or going backwards or being vulnerable.
I think that, and our facility is also a great example of a facility that has a wonderful summer program. So a lot of the kids that are in the UPK program can continue to roll over and be there in summer, and that's great. But I love the idea of, you know, you might lose the argument immediately if you approach somebody and say we have to completely dismantle the calendar and do something different. But the idea of having expansive summer programs like you were talking about Fairport offering, like we offer in the city, and making it more clear that those are available to families would be a great way to sort of begin that bridge between the calendar year ending and the new school year beginning.
One listener writes to say, Evan, your guests are demonstrating why teachers deserve more compensation, tactical support, and accolades than executives and CEOs, because so often they bend over backwards to go above and beyond for each individual student. I'm sure our guests appreciate that, but let's talk seriously. How much does teacher pay still impact how many people want to come into this field?
I think it does. You know, I started, I made $7,000 a year when I started, but it was 1976. So it was a while ago.
I was like doing the math. I'm like, what? How old are you?
Yeah. I'll be 68 next month. And, you know, and I ended up making, it's everything, everything's online. I think I was making like $107,000 a year after 41 years in teaching. And then I, of course, took a major pay cut, but I also took a pension when I left Fairport School. So I'm fairly well compensated, but it took, and here's the problem, it took 30 years to be well compensated. And a lot of people, because of student debt, so if you have $40,000 in student debt, and that's probably less, that's about the average maybe, I don't know, somebody could correct me from your audience. And now you're going to take a job starting at, you know, $38,000 a year. The economics are tough. And I am concerned about induction of new teachers. But generally speaking, I don't think compensation is the biggest issue.
That's not the number one.
I don't think so. I think respect is part of it. I think that another part of it is the difficulty of the job. It's just really hard. And I know it's not always smart to make comparisons, but I generally compare the teaching profession to the nursing profession in many ways. It's a caregiving profession. It's exhausting. And the metric is, did you serve your client? You know, and so it takes a certain person to do it, and money's important. I needed to raise my family on one income. My father raised 10 children on a teacher's income. He had side hustles. I've had side hustles all my life. You can't do it without a side hustle with one income. And some people don't want to sign up for that. And so I don't want to I negotiated teacher contracts for 30 years. I mean, they're very, very important. But still not the number one issue.
I got you. You have side hustles too, John.
Four or five, yeah. I used to say before I was a teacher, I don't have a 9-to-5, but I have 5 to 9 different jobs.
But, that's good.
Yeah,
John Baines is going, I never thought of that one. That was a good one.
That's a good line, brother.
I definitely do, and that's not just because of artistic passions, but also because of I need to sustain a lifestyle.
Yeah.
And teaching doesn't necessarily give you that, but I do think that aside from compensation, it's a general idea that most teachers feel now more than ever they're doing this amazing juggling act behind the curtain every day to get one day in a classroom functional takes this huge amount of work that nobody necessarily sees or thanks them for, and they feel especially now, or I feel especially now, that there's a longer list of jobs to do. You have to be online on Zoom and virtually communicating, yeah. And then also in person, and how can we designate that more in a cohesive manner to a job so that one person doesn't feel completely overwhelmed trying to juggle all those different fields at once.
Yeah, let me jump in on that too and say that when you're a new teacher, you haven't built your repertoire. So you're surviving and you're building a repertoire of activities, lessons, you're developing your skills, your content awareness. So the most difficult years that you'll have in terms of stress as far as the working with children technically and pedagogically will be the first 10 years. So the first 10 years are really, really hard. Emotionally, the job gets harder over time. So you can be a 30-year teacher and it's easier for you to do the work, but it's emotionally more difficult because of just the wear and tear on you for all those years. And you could analogize that in some ways to like law enforcement. you know, and other professions that engage the public, where we, you know, we have fairly early retirement options. But I do want to also talk a little bit about, I think, what the big issue is. I think the big issue, and before we get to your next listener, is what are we going to do about remote learning? We as a society said, we mandated families to go on remote learning. We said, you will do this. Now, do we mandate that they not do it? That's kind of dissonant. Like, how do you say, this is what you have to do, and then you turn around and say, this is what you can't do? Because one of the dirty little secrets of the pandemic is that some of the kids preferred remote learning, and they liked it. Mm-hmm. Kids who really struggle in school, you know, we used to call it, it's a primitive term, school phobic, but now there's more precise ways of talking about relationships that certain children have with the school environment. And there are students who benefited from remote learning. Now, they had certain circumstances with their families, they had the right technology or the right circumstance. I don't know how to. I don't know the answer to that.
Do we still offer them
that? That's what I'm asking.
Exactly.
And then if we do, are we asking teachers to do synchronous learning between their remote students and while they're presenting in a classroom? I mean, I had this wonderful student who was remote for a medical reason, and the other students would say, "Mr. Baines, you got to turn the camera on." Mm-hmm. And I feel so ashamed. And I was like, "Oh,"
yeah.
And this girl had the most beautiful dimple. She always gave me the big smile. And I go, "I'm so sorry. When I have people in front of me." I'm kind of a ham and an extrovert and a performer. So I see students, they walk in the room, I fist bump them, well, I elbow bump them this year. And then, you know, I'm saying, hey, what's going on? How's your game? And I forget.
So you're admitting that there's a natural tendency to maybe not be as focused on the students who are remote.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. When it's happening at the same time, especially, the whole beat of the class is completely different online than it is in person.
It's way easier to have either everybody online or everybody in the room.
But what I'm hearing from both of you is that if we are going to reach students more effectively, we are going to see that students learn differently from student to student to student. And some of the students, not all, probably not even a majority, probably a small group, but some, this was better for them. And what are you going to do about that?
Their parents are saying that. And some of the students, I have hyper-articulate students, are saying that.
Yeah.
So here's, you know, it may be a possible solution would be that you're on a track. I mean, a lot of schools have an alternative school, right? So it's an anti-dropout program. They have them in many, many schools where after school, certain kids who can't function. Well, it's the same model. We may have kids who are wholly remote. So a teacher may have four live classes and then may teach a remote class during the day if they have a schedule with five classes. So, again, these things are not insurmountable.
Could you see that, John Lewis?
I definitely can. I like that idea of a hybrid version of what we've had to do now becoming more the norm as we go forward, where we can offer some students specifically Zoom. I mean, I had one student who their family had to go on a trip, and they were gone for a week, but they could still Zoom in Florida, you know, and then that family, because we had that offered, were able to be present with us every day, regardless of the fact that they were gone in a different state.
The enrichment opportunities, like I wanted my kids to watch 1964, the incredible documentary that everybody has to watch about the race riots in Rochester. It's one of the greatest documents
from Carbon Eisen, I think.
Oh, God, yeah. It's so good. So I said, hey, I'm going to make it optional. And then we're going to do, and my daughter, Sheila, whom you've met, came on from Washington. And I brought in guests. I can bring in guests from all over the country for enrichment and say, hey, kids, just come to this, you know, if you want to. But the other thing is that when you're remote, you can't have security on your assignments. You can't really give quizzes. It's like I was reading Beloved in the spring of 20. And so we're reading Beloved, and it's so hard, the book, right? So I would say, okay, kids, we're going to have a little quiz just to say, and just to pay you for reading it. Like, it'll be one question, you get 10 points, right? And then we had what we started calling a Beloved Book Club, where I'm like, you guys, in 3 seconds, I'm going to have you paste into the chat of the Zoom the answer to the prompt I gave you yesterday that was guiding your reading. So all of a sudden, 26 women paste in these brilliant comments. Then I'm saying, okay, everybody make a cup of tea after you read this excerpt and think about it while you're making your cup of tea. And then I'm in my kitchen, right? So we had some great lessons, but we were missing each other. And there was, you know, I don't want to go back to that. But I also realized this is powerful. And we have to use it like all powerful tools in a smart way.
But like any medicine, it can be overused.
Mm-hmm. Oh, totally.
Yes. I think that all teachers, a lot of employee, or a lot of different people who are in the workforce, but teachers especially, were seeing a blurred line between their home life and what they were doing for school. Yeah. Like, you know, you're at home, but you could maybe, I could cook something for a kid if they signed on late and talk about what it's like to make waffles, you know? And that's what gets you to start to think, of course, we don't want to have that be how things are. But now that you see how those lines can blur, you start to think about how can we evolve our system now.
Yeah, our colleagues at WXXI, and shout out to Kara and everyone who's worked so hard to stay in touch with educators and school systems. I'm looking at all these kits, these wonderful green kits, making a seed ball, creative nature observation kits, all of the stuff that you could find in throughout the past year at WXXI.org/education and the education department. They've been so good, and people have really responded. I mean, we see, nature-based schooling. There's a lot of open doors for the moment. The question is, can you weave that in without losing the core of what needs to always be there for education?
Let me throw this at you, Evan, and your listeners. One of the biggest movements in American education pre-pandemic was the movement to homeschooling. And it's a complex array of factors that involve people making that choice. So we can sit here as educators and say, okay, we're going to go back to the way we did it with our agrarian-based calendar, and we're going to do it the way we did it in the old days because that is, quote, normal. I don't think we have to blow anything up, but I do believe that we have to think differently about providing help. And this is what WXX, I was talking about my wife's library. You know, I was a little frustrated when all the schools were shut down, and I'm thinking, can't we have families sign out the gym? We have, how many gyms do we have in the schools? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Can't we have a family like mom and dad and daughter and son shoot hoops for 30 minutes? Just 30 minutes. Come in with masks and doors open by appointment. Can't we have those libraries? I mean, every school in Rochester has an unbelievably beautiful library. We have parents looking for resources. I think the next time around we're going to be more prepared to give learning kits and other things to help kids. And we shouldn't be ashamed. We should just say, hey, we're going to learn from this and we're going to be better.
Yeah, I get you there.
I like that comparison to homeschooling too, because I think that there's so beneficial in some ways to homeschooling, but also a stigma involved usually, especially when it was first being introduced, of people thinking that it was not the right thing to do just because of it not being part of what we had accepted already. So if we can talk about asynchronous learning or virtual learning without the stigma that we had approached to homeschooling at first, maybe we can get the benefits out of it quicker.
Don't tell parents they're wrong.
Okay? You're right.
I'm in this game a long
time. Yeah, right.
Exactly. We're not in the business of judging parents and telling them they're wrong. We're not smarter than parents. Parents are their children's first teachers. I work for parents. And I used to say to teachers, if you don't think you work for parents, you're not going to last long.
Right.
Let me keep it tight here. Mel in Penfield wants to jump in. Go ahead, Mel.
Hi, boys. I could relate to on so many levels with this conversation. First of all, as a grandparent who really had our 6-year-old grandson for 3 days a week during the pandemic, and it was a challenge. But I got to give a huge shout out to the teachers. They were fabulous in helping us. His older sisters were helpful in just getting us online, because you know many of us are Luddites and as grandparents and don't understand the technology. But, yeah, a huge shout-out to teachers. In fact, we gave gifts to his teacher at the end of the school year because she was so wonderful, and the whole team was so wonderful in supporting us. But also to comment about John's comment about comparing teachers and nurses. As a nurse, yes, it takes years to be able to get the compensation that you're worth. And a lot of heartache, a lot of hard work, but it's a wonderful profession, both teachers and nurses, I think, value their profession, and I'm grateful for both of them.
Mel, thank you, and to you and all the nurses, Not enough love and respect, especially in the last 16 months. Thank you for what you have been doing. Let me squeeze in real quick here. Marcy says, all the things you're talking about in today's show regarding education are great, but there's nothing better than having one or two adults working closely with a child, whether with hard copies of books or other materials or online. I facilitate the Buddy Readers program for Spiritus Christi Church with three city schools. We used Zoom during the pandemic, along with several online libraries and many additional online resources. Each child worked in a breakout with one or two adult buddy readers. Students helped select books they wanted to read, got help with their phonics and sight words. This really made a difference. Some students would attend for six or more hours on their asynchronous learning days by their own choice. Our schools want buddy readers to continue our online work along with working in person. The key to this is building close, caring relationships. Marcy, that's awesome. That's a great example that sort of supplements what John and John have been talking about doing things a little differently and reaching people. And in our last 30 seconds, I just got to ask you about music. Shout out to my neighbor, Chris Gold, who teaches, and I've heard him doing online music lessons, but it's not quite the same, and he was so eager to get back in person. What is your concern, if any, about arts and the idea that, well, I guess we're just going to do theater or we're not going to do this? Can we get those things back, and how vital are they?
Yes, and especially because they tend to be first on the chopping block when you talk about what can and cannot be done. And as a musician and in my position at school being heavily based in what I can play and perform musically, they told me at first, when you come back in, you have to wear a mask and you can't sing. Because you are not, you might spit more. And so I had all of a sudden realized I can't, you know, do that. But I think that we need to continue to emphasize, especially at a younger age, how those arts can truly connect the child to a higher grade of education later on.
When you talk about joy, which is its own hour that we didn't get to, so much of that comes from extracurriculars, art, etc., that a lot of students lost in the last year or were modified back. That is one thing I do want to see return full force or more.
Yes. It better.
But so many great suggestions. And we got a flood of email in the last, like, 10 minutes. So I promise, listeners, we'll do more of this summer with teachers.
And let me say this. Yeah. Face-to-face is everything. We're going to get back to it. I love it. I wouldn't have done it all these years without face-to-face. It's the magic. I love the magic of being with children. And all these other things are great, but face-to-face. Like, I'm great to be back in your studio.
I know, to see your face.
Great. John Baines, John Lewis, two teachers. Thank you, guys. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so
delighted.
Much.
More connections coming up.